Mahamudra, Eliminating the Darkness of Ignorance by the Ninth Karmapa. Part 3, Mahamudra Vipassana Meditation. The second main section is the exceptionally perceptive state of Vipassana, having the essential points of your body posture be as before, but in this case, as your way of gazing is extremely important, direct your eyes intensely wide open, straight ahead at the center of the empty space before you, without blinking, wavering to and fro, or fluttering, and gaze ahead, staring. Within a state of that faultless settling of your mind and shamatha as you have attained before, set your mind tranquilly into its natural mode, non-manufactured, unself-conscious, not anxiously caring, drop down to its natural state, but make it slightly more intense. Keep your mindfulness on the ever-present moment, vividly transparent, wide awake, and without meandering. Having done that, examine extensively the essential nature of your mind at this time when it is in perfect full shamatha. By its essential nature, does it have a color, a form, a shape? Does it have an arising, a ceasing, and an enduring? Or does it lack the three? Is it outside, inside, or where is it settled? Except for the settled state itself, is there actually another awareness knowable to the side of it? Is it nothing whatsoever, a blank void that cannot be identified as this or that? Or in this settled state is there awareness, which, although it cannot be identified as this or that, is still vividly transparent, pristine, and distinct, but which you do not know how to express in words? Moreover, is that essential nature of the settled mind a pitch blackness, or is it a sparkling, wide-awake starkness? All mistakes and key points concerning the abiding nature of the mind are contained in this questioning. So, if gripped by concerns about the eight transitory things in life, you're hoodwinked yourself into claiming that, without having developed anything on your mental continuum, you've actually developed on it fantastic boon experiences and stable realizations, which are merely objects of your intellectual understanding, things you have merely heard about, and just highfalutin Dharma jargon, then you've deceived yourself. And if you are a renunciate, then you've also caused your vows to degenerate by lying to your guru with polite affectations. So put your heartfelt effort into the practice just by itself, and then, since it's necessary to have genuine experience and realization that develop within you through the force of meditation and not through patching up something through conceptual thought, tighten your faculty of awareness and examine your mind. Then take a rest, and afterwards examine once more. As it is necessary to examine the essential nature of the mind when it is settled, the way to set it throughout these occasions is to set it in a clear, lucid, brilliant state, like the sun free of all clouds. Since occasionally re-energizing your faculty of awareness and then exerting yourself to examine the essential nature of your settled mind is the first method enabling you to get to know the nature of your mind face to face, the guru as well must discipline and question in accord with the measure of mind of you disciples. To make some of you fit to be trained, he must repeat and question over and again to ensure that you have gotten to know, face to face, an intellectual understanding, a boon experience, a stable realization, and a genuine experience without mixing them with Dharma jargon. You disciples as well must exert effort like that. Examining the essential nature of the settled mind, then, is the first point for Vipassana meditation. Next, to cut down to the foundation and root for resolving the issue of the essential nature of your mind, you need to cut down to the root from atop the stirring mind or rambling conceptual thought so that you will get to know face to face its essential nature. Having adopted the essential points of body posture, way of gazing, acting, and so forth as before, then in a state of the triad, bliss, clarity, and non-conceptuality, crystal clear and relaxed, generate all of a sudden a fleeting conceptual thought from that state, or emanate a conceptual thought in whatever way seems suitable. Examine the essential nature of the cognition that has been emanating. Examine it at the time it is emanating. Having examined the enduring of what has been emanating, investigate what is its color, its shape, and is there a place it arose from, a place it endured in, and a place it ceased into? Is this conceptual thought located outside, or is it located inside the body? Wherever this aspect of mind might be, outside or inside the body, for instance, if in fact inside, the center of your heart or the likes, in what manner does it endure, and is it emanating? Does that mind that is emanating exist as a functional phenomenon, Or does it exist as a non-functional phenomenon? Does it actually have an arising, a ceasing, a color, a shape, and so on? If it does, then what kind does it have? Or is it the case that you say that you think it doesn't have these? And even if you say that it cannot be thought of as being like this, well then, is there still something knowable that nevertheless has no arising or ceasing and so forth? At the moment when you examine a conceptual thought, is it that there is an absence there of all conceptual thoughts, aparting from mental fabrication without an arising or a ceasing? Or is it that in having examined that conceptual thought, it just goes away, vividly discharging without leaving a trace? Which one is it? Or is the measure that conceptual thoughts have arisen just that they pop up without being identifiable as being like this or like that? Examine, is it really like that? If it is the case that they pop up without being identifiable, then at that moment when they do pop up, is there or is there not another thought that thinks there is no identifiable component here? After a conceptual thought has stirred up, or you have made one stir up, examine it without stopping it or grasping onto it. Whether it has a happy feeling to it or an unhappy one, examine the essential nature of happy and unhappy thoughts. No matter how many thoughts you have, examine them. When a disturbing emotion has arisen strongly, such as one of the five poisons of desire, anger, naivety, pride, or jealousy, or you make one arise, examine it too, making sure to cut out any interpolations you might superimpose from within. Examine the conceptual thought itself and the object of that thought and its immediately preceding conceptual thought to see whether there is any difference in terms of the mind or consciousness aspect of them. When you see the essential nature of conceptual thought as clarity-making, knowing, and starkness, then examine whether there is actually any difference between the clarity-making, knowing, and starkness you saw previously with respect to the settled mind and the clarity-making, knowing, and starkness you see now with respect to conceptual thought. If you cannot decide, then draw that conceptual thought itself back in and set your mind in a state of clarity-making and knowing. In other words, as you will now be examining the essential nature of your normal awareness itself, unadulterated by anything, which originally had a conceptual thought pop up in it, examine it thoroughly and so on. In short, when, having adjusted to the way that thoughts dawn in your mind and to your understanding of them, you have made decisive distinctions through the two of you, guru and disciple, working together, then you have cut down to the depths and to the foundation and root for resolving the issue of the essential nature of your mind. Exerting effort in getting to know face to face the essential nature of your mind through examining it when it is stirring with conceptual thought, and the procedures for examining it are the second point for Vipassana meditation. Further, in order to get to know face-to-face appearances and the mind as being inseparable, there is examination of the essential nature of the mind from when it is focused atop an appearance. While having your way of gazing and body posture as before, direct your eyes and your focus single-pointedly at any suitable visual form in the space before you. Some definite object such as a pillar, a vase, or a reflection of your body in a mirror, or Mount Meru, and examine it staring piercingly. Then, after setting your awareness that is atop that object into a loosened state for a short while, examine once again. Likewise, examine the essential nature of a sound that is the cognitive object of your ears, whether or not there is a difference in essential nature between a pleasant and an unpleasant, or a loud and a soft one, such as that spoken by yourself and someone else, and so on. Similarly, whatever dawns, a fragrant or a foul odor that appears as a cognitive object of your nose, a delicious or unpalatable taste to your tongue, a pleasant or unpleasant, hot or cold, or intensely painful physical sensation to your body, examine it. At that time, alternate examining each of the five types of sensory objects, whichever they may be, and the examiner conceptual minds that are examining them by considering, is it that when an appearance ceases, the mind also goes away? Or is it that the mind itself and the appearance appear separately? Or is it that the appearance is present and arises by coming into the mind? Or is it that, for the mind to make the appearance appear, it goes out to take hold of the appearance, thinking, I shall make this appear? Or is it the case that, since appearances in the mind are inseparable, an appearance without an object that it is an appearance of, is there distinctly in a void? Having examined whether there is really a difference between those two, namely a mind and an appearance, then examine as follows for what is the difference between an appearance that is a cognitive object and a conceptual mind that has it as its object. When you have examined an object, if the cognitive object is really out there, vividly clear, different and separate from the mind perceiving it, then whether there is a whimsical thought that is thinking those words, it is out there, or there isn't any thinking of those words, it wouldn't matter. It would only seem as though there is a difference at all between those two, that object out there and that mind that is examining it, unobstructed and plainly evident, but which, on its own part, does not take anything as its cognitive object, does not make anything clearly appear, and is just naturally in a comfortable state. But actually, since the cognitive object would in fact be out there, different and separate from the mind perceiving it, there couldn't be any thought thinking something different from those words that it is out there. However, if it is just a whimsical thought that is thinking that the object is out there, vividly clear, but it really isn't out there, then examine that whimsical thought itself, which is thinking those words, it is out there. What kind of thought is that? Is its object out there? Likewise, examine as well both the body and the mind. Which are they? One and the same or different? If they are one and the same, then the body, which has an arising and a ceasing, and the mind, which, being eternal, is parted from any arising or ceasing, the two would have to be the same. Or if they are different, then you should be able to recognize two separate things, the body and the mind, totally apart from each other. The mind, without being located here, pervades the entire body, not just its top or its bottom, so that you experience feelings all over. How is that? The body and mind are respectively something that supports and something supported, like a cup and the tea in it. But if the body is outside and the mind inside is two separate things, like a man in his clothing, then consider that experience itself of a feeling. If you are of the mind that thinks that it is the body alone that has feelings, then a corpse would also have to have feelings. But if the mind alone had the feelings, then the two, body and mind, would have to be different and unrelated. Now, the mind is something that cannot be killed or cut. But if, when your body is pricked by a thorn, your mind feels it, then how is that not the same as the example of when the supporting clothes being worn by someone are burned by a fire, the supported man, wearing them, is also burned by the fire? Since, having thoroughly examined with that kind of analysis, you need to be able to reach a decisive conclusion, then at this very point, know as your mind, like water and waves, all feelings that arise, and set your mind on that realization. Because it is within that state that you will have become decisive from your depths about the abiding nature of your mind, examining like that is the third point for Vipassana meditation. Examine once more the essential nature of your mind at the time when it is settled pristinely in its clarity-making and voidness, in other words, emptiness. Then again, after having made it stir with a conceptual thought and having examined its essential nature, examine whether the essential natures of the settled and stirring minds are the same or different. Having examined like that, if you see that they are different, then how are they different? Do the settled and stirring minds dawn by alternating, like when you have strung thread around two sticks spread apart and twirl the two threads together with equal strength to make a string? Is a settled mind like the ground and the stirring mind that arises like what grows in a field? Or are the two states, settled and stirring, like a coiled snake or rope, and that there is just a rope and it is either straight or coiled, so that when one state is the case, the other isn't happening? Is it that the mind is something that while it is settled, it isn't moving, and while it is moving, it isn't settled? However, concerning that, since when it is stirring, the mind emanates a variety of all different things, and when it is settled, it remains without stirring, the difference between those two states is great. But if you think their essential natures are different, is the difference between the two in terms of color, shape, and so forth? Or is it a difference in terms of something like the trio arising, enduring, and ceasing, or a no longer happening, not yet happening, and presently happening, and so on, or static, permanent, and non-static, and permanent? Examine. In fact, when you know conceptual thought is something also to be included within the sphere of meditation, you realize that the essential nature of both the settled and stirring minds is nothing but the same. The way they dawn is that they dawn by alternating, and when your mind is settled, there is nothing that is stirring, and when it is stirring, there is nothing that is settled. Like water and waves, the two states are the gate or action of the mind alone. That is all there is to it. When you understand that both the settled and stirring minds are nothing more than stark clarity-making and voidness, then you have a little understanding. However, after you have drawn a conceptual thought in and set your mind in meditation, is it that now there is in fact a clarity making in voidness? Or is it that in the wake of the thought having disappeared, there is in fact a clarity making in voidness? Or is it that the plainly evident conceptual thought itself was in fact a clarity making in voidness? If you think that it is like either of the former two, you must still make strong requests to your guru for inspiration, and then make effort once more to examine and try to gain certainty in seeing how it really is. As for those who have gone through these stages of examining the essential nature of the mind, those who skip ahead develop vipassana first, then shamatha, and then sometimes they have neither and sometimes both will dawn. Those for whom it happens at once develop both shamatha and vipassana at the same time by merely being taught the mental labels for them. This is due to the power of their previous training. Those who progress gradually develop the two in stages. Here, as the explanation has been made under the influence of the latter type of person's approach, it must be taught like this only after assessing the way in which the disciple's experiences dawn. For that way of practicing, then, when examining in fact the essential nature of the mind, set your mind in a state in which there is an aspect of clarity-making, but no aspect of conceptual grasping, like a small child looking at the paintings of deities in a temple. Within that state, exert yourself with great perseverance to examine in this way. Having rid yourself of laziness and turned away from clinging, having no requirements and being renounced, having firm conviction in your guru, appreciation of him or her, and belief in facts, and having mindfulness firm with no meandering, practice in an uncontrived state without being fettered by any hopes or worries. Having taken interest in only your future lives, having not gone into the slackness of rambling about after things of this life, if you make effort in these ways of examining the mind, then it is impossible for you not to develop quickly and with certainty this much deep awareness, that of vipassana. Therefore, ascertaining the essential natures of both the settled and stirring minds together is the fourth point for vipassana meditation. By having cultivated like that, examining the essential nature of your mind in that way, and meditating according to the quintessence teachings concerning the mind, then, with practically no need for your guru to get you to know its nature face to face, stable realizations of it will come springing up to you spontaneously from within. Some people, however, do not recognize it even if this has happened, and some, wishing to have developed excellent boon experiences and stable realizations quickly, with merely an intellectual understanding and dry listening to teachings about the nature of the mind, only with their ears, will speak of these experiences and realizations with unerring Dharma jargon, despite their not having developed them. Since such can be heard, the guru must differentiate those types of people, and the disciple as well must practice taking all this to heart. As a beginner, the first way to get to know face-to-face the essential nature of your mind at the time when you are examining it is as follows. Having carried out, as before, the ways to examine the essential nature of your previously settled mind and so on, that essential nature of the settled mind will, in fact, be right there. The essential nature of what that mind is a vividly transparent, glaringly distinct, pristine, relaxed awareness which, within a state of a sparkling, vividly awake starkness, and not just an absence, can nevertheless not be identified as a this or a that. Yet, while not being identifiable as something that, with a shape, color, and so on, is like this, or that can be said to be expressible in words as being like that and that, it is nevertheless an awareness that makes things clear without obstruction, crystal clear, pristine, stark, distinct, and vividly wide awake. But it's not something that you think to yourself, it's something I'm seeing that I have not seen before, something that I'm experiencing that I had not experienced before, something that I'm knowing that I had not known before. It's not like that. It's not even a something that you can put into words as being like this. There's something there that is dawning to me. But if your decisiveness about the essential nature of your mind is just an intellectual understanding that it is a clear, serene, unidentifiable, settled state of clarity-making and voidness, then, because that is unreliable, not the slightest attainment will come from it. On the other hand, if it is a decisive statement that it has dawned from within from your own meditation practice, that is a dawning of an exceptionally perceptive state of vipassana into the essential nature of the settled mind. Therefore, except for perceiving this essential nature in a denuding manner through a tremendous effort, like pressing a rock against a broken bone to set it, there is no other way to attain vipassana into it. Otherwise, if your guru tries to get you to know the nature of your mind face to face prematurely, you will be left with it as an object of only an intellectual understanding, and you will become close-minded and smug. Then, because of the harm inflicted, even attempts to lead you with further instructions and the like cannot bring you to get to know it face to face. This is because, without having cut the stream of your conceptual thoughts, you will not have seen the essential nature of your mind. Without having seen its essential nature, your guru will not have been able to bring you to know it face to face. Having not met it face to face, your meditation will not be able to function as a pathway of mind leading to liberation and enlightenment. Therefore, even at times when you have excellent boon experiences, examine them, and at times when your meditation is going poorly, repeatedly try to intensify the clarity. Remember, teaching the methods for cultivating meditation practice is called forward-leading discursive instruction, while knowing for meditation carried out by following those instructions is called the completed state of discursive instruction. As that is the case, then if you have cultivated your meditation practice without having meandered from that state of completed instruction, you will have no difficulty in having developed boon experiences and stable realizations. When, through that route, you have seen the essential nature of your mind, then, because it will have instilled certainty in you and cut off your doubts, now you will be able to get to know that nature face to face. Of the two states that are achieved in general in meditation, shamatha and vipassana, look for the following to check for the first. When your mind has been set, relaxed into its natural mode, all conceptual thoughts automatically still in their own place, and your mind settles clearly and serenely into its natural mode. Your intellect does not enter into mental wandering about worldly matters of this life. Your mind is blissful, soft, with all disturbing emotions stilled into a fine sleep. Settled single-pointedly into its essential nature of being constructive, your mind remains like that for as long as you wish, under your own control. You do not feel even the passing of breath in and out. If your state of mind is actually one like this, that is a distinguished, stilled, and settled state of shamatha. That state has as its main, most important features the boon experiences of bliss, clarity, and non-conceptuality. Although these boon experiences cannot serve the function of stable realizations, which are attainable only with vipassana, nevertheless, you cannot do without them. If you have cultivated them without any clinging, then in that state of mind, without lapsing into mental dullness, flightiness of mind, or an unspecified state of indifference, you will see that the essential nature of the mind is that it is something parted from any expression, thought, or talk that its shape or color is like this. Inexpressible in words as being something knowable and able to be experienced as an object of your own intellect as being like this, it is like the bliss of a youth, a unified pair of clarity-making and voidness, parted from all extremes of being something that can be identified and then mentally fabricated, unadulterated by any conceptual Dharma thoughts, unsullied by any conceptual worldly thoughts. Unsuitable, if identified as being a lethargic state of shamatha or of non-conceptuality, it is an awareness that is sitting there, naturally present all along, dropped down to its own state, naturally simple. It is called normal awareness, or simply the mind, the root of all good qualities. If you are unaware of it, then there is unknowing, ignorance, and uncontrollably recurring samsara. But if you are aware of it, then there is knowing and deep awareness, or the released state of nirvana. It is either called simultaneously arising deep awareness, or it is called the primordial state, or clear light, or the exceptionally perceptive state of vipassana. Therefore, now, when you get to know it face to face, is the dividing point for giving a nod to samsara and nirvana. From having had your guru bring you to know face to face the essential nature of your mind, your disciples will recognize it like meeting someone with whom you were familiar long ago. That recognition is called recognition of the mind. Its essential nature is not something produced by the great discriminating awareness of a disciple or the skillful guideline instructions of a guru. From the start, your mind has been abiding with an essential nature like that. But because previously it had been obscured by disturbing emotions and conceptual thoughts, you did not recognize it. But now that the stream of your conceptual thoughts has been cut, and if you have gotten to know that essential nature face to face, you are aware of it. Concerning the mind, that crystal clear clarity making that cannot be identified as this or that, and which, while lacking a self nature as an existent or a non-existent mind, nevertheless has the defining characteristic of a mind, namely vividly transparent appearance making, What is the essential nature of that void clarity-making awareness? A crystal clear limpidness without a break in continuity, that is the essential nature of the mind. If you cultivate a denuding recognition of the essential nature of the mind as being that, without ever wavering from it, then from among the unimaginable benefits from that, there will be the dawning of an exceptionally perceptive state of vipassana into the settled mind. Since that is a state of having met face to face mind's essential nature, getting to know this essential nature face to face atop the settled non-conceptual mind is the first actual fundamental step in attaining a state of vipassana. So once you have pierced through to your mind's vital point, further practice and continual cultivation of your meditation is extremely important. Thus, recognizing the essential nature of the settled mind in that way and cultivating it are the fifth point for vipassana meditation. With a second way of examining, namely examining the essential nature of the stirring mind, you cut down to the foundation and root for resolving the issue of the essential nature of your mind. Now, to go further, you need to know that there are two ways to get to know face-to-face that essential nature. One, getting to know it face-to-face atop the non-conceptual settled mind, and two, getting to know it face-to-face atop the stirring mind or atop conceptual thought. With the latter, getting to know it face-to-face atop the stirring mind, referring to when it has stirred with a conceptual thought, or you have made it stir with one. The first, namely getting to know face-to-face the essential nature of your mind atop the non-conceptual settled mind, was as follows. Your awareness was settled into a non-conceptual state, serenely, clearly, crystal clearly, parted from mental dullness and flightiness of mind. By having examined that awareness, you realized that it was not even something that could be thought of as being the this within the context of the whimsical thought. There isn't any color, shape, or the likes to it, or an arising or a ceasing. Yet, you also realize that there is in fact something knowable as being without an arising or a ceasing. When you had such type of stable realization, that was an arising of an exceptionally perceptive state of vipassana into the non-conceptual mind. Now, as for the second way, if after having examined the stirring mind, you said that all conceptual thoughts that had stirred were a bare void departed from an arising and a ceasing, that was talk of a literal void, and you had gone to the extreme of nihilism. But suppose you realize that in having examined conceptual thoughts, then parted from their having the trio of an arising, enduring, and ceasing, and from their being identifiable as being a color, a shape, or the likes, there was simply a vivid discharging of them without their leaving a trace. If that were the case, then stable realization has arisen a little. However, suppose that, without even a whimsical thought that conceptual thoughts are unidentifiable, you realize that conceptual thoughts simultaneously dawn and liberate themselves by automatically subsiding without being identifiable as something unimportant and not to be grasped. If that were the case, then you had met the essential nature of the stirring mind face to face. Or, alternatively, suppose that you realize that conceptual thought and the objects of thought, the mind at the time when it's settled and at the time when it's stirring, previous minds and previous thoughts and so on, without being good or bad or having the slightest difference in essential nature, are all equally clarity-making, knowing, and starkness. And suppose that you also realize that, without being the case that in the wake of having drawn in a conceptual thought, or in the wake of a thought having disappeared, the conceptual thought had gone into a clarity-making and voidness, but rather that the conceptual thoughts that suddenly arise were themselves a dawning of clarity-making and voidness. If that were the case, then you have also met the essential nature of the stirring mind. Now, with either of these two ways of meeting the essential nature of the stirring mind, there is not even the slightest thing to differentiate from a non-conceptual settled state, your realization in which the mind stirred with conceptual thoughts, the settled mind, and the essential nature of conceptual thought itself. All three sit denuded in clarity-making and voidness. You had differentiated the essential natures of the settled and the stirring minds, because your intellect, not having recognized the essential nature of conceptual thought, had considered it to be taken as different from that of the settled non-conceptual mind after having interpolated the difference. Previously, when you did not recognize the essential nature of conceptual thoughts, you were unable to take them into your meditation, and there was unknowing or ignorance. Therefore, now that you recognize them, thoughts themselves can be your meditation, and you will remain in deep awareness. So now make the root of your meditation be conceptual thoughts. Previous to that, the thoughts themselves were obscuring themselves, and so they were something you couldn't see. Now that there is an awareness of meditation atop conceptual thought, which is especially more distinguished than meditation atop the non-conceptual settled mind, then whatever conceptual thoughts may dawn, make them into something you have recognized. When they have not arisen, stay in the mental state of them not having arisen. There is no need to emanate them. But when they have arisen, stay there in the mental state of them having arisen. There is no need to collect them back. Therefore, without making any reflection whatsoever concerning hopes or worries, make the essential nature of your meditation be conceptual thoughts themselves. Conceptual thoughts are nothing more than the mind. That mind, which automatically liberates itself as a vivid discharging that naturally dissolves in its own place, is a dharmakaya, a corpus encompassing everything, by essential nature, a stark clarity making in voidness, parted from something to be liberated and something to do the liberating. Since that is the case, then stable realization like that is the dawning of an exceptionally perceptive state of vipassana into conceptual thought, and thus a state of having met face to face the essential nature of the mind as being dharmakaya, a unified pair of clarity making and voidness. In short, whatever conceptual thoughts dawn, make them into something you recognize, and having set your mind atop just that, without contriving and without meandering, be sure to cultivate that realization. Getting to know mind's essential nature face to face atop the stirring mind, then, is the second actual fundamental step for attaining a state of vipassana. Having met it face to face, however, is not enough. Cultivating it continually is the sixth point for vipassana meditation. The third step in getting to know face to face the essential nature of the mind is getting to know its nature face to face atop appearances as being inseparable appearance mind. By having examined some appropriate object, one of the five types of external sense objects, a sight, sound, smell, taste, or tactile sensation, and so forth, you observed an unobstructed, plainly evident cognitive object, without even a whimsical thought that that object is sitting out there. You also observed a mind doing the examining of it, which, without your grasping it as even a that, was a vivid discharging. You realize that those two, the appearance of the cognitive object in the mind, were neither the same thing nor different separate things, but without even thinking that they were neither the same nor different. Likewise, you realize that body and mind are also inseparable, without being either the same or different, a unified pair of clarity-making voidness and appearance voidness, like the appearance of the moon and water. Consider now even your feelings, hot, cold, and so on. They appear, but you need to realize that by not being aware of them as appearance voidness, your mind imputes them conceptually as being truly established as hot and cold, and thus you have limitless grasping. But except for that being so, you need to realize that what is actually established as the ultimate phenomenon is totally parted from a body and mind that are in any way bases for imputing feelings. To gain this realization, direct your intensely staring way of gazing and your mind single-pointedly at whatever appearance pops up before you, such as your finger. Then, a little while after that, release your stare. Observe that, at first, the finest details of the cognitive objects are there, vividly clear. But a little while after that, the appearance gets switched off automatically in its own place because either you turned away, being disgusted and not wanting to look at it anymore, or your eyes went numb or started to tear. But then, having gazed at it again a little while after that, an appearance distinctly knowable as something that cannot be grasped separately from the mind comes again, getting switched on automatically in its own place. At that point, when the mind itself and this appearance are there inseparably, distinctly knowable as appearance voidness, not as separately established objects, realize that what you're observing is the reflexive appearance of the abiding nature of reality or the defining characteristic of the mind. By means of that, realize that there are no two different separate things, external appearances and an internal mind, but just the mind's reflexive brilliance dawning with no obstruction. Because appearances as separately established objects to be grasped do not exist, awarenesses that conceptually grasp them are in fact dawnings of deception. At the time of those dawnings, those appearances cannot be singled out as separate things. They appear because your mind is deceiving itself. Therefore, except for mind being appearances, there are no such things as appearances or cognitive objects that can be established even to the slightest degree as things that are extraneous to the mind. Previously, you were in a situation of seeing seemingly external appearances due to the actual nature of appearances having been obscured by unawareness or by your mental faculties conceptually grasping for separately established cognitive objects. But now that the stream of your grasping conceptual thoughts has been cut, you are in a situation of recognizing mind itself as being without separately existing cognitive objects. Mind is the mental activity of light rays of Dharmakaya arising simultaneously with appearances, in which the appearances are distinctly knowable as an utter voidness without cognitive objects and without conceptually grasping of appearances. With this recognition, now cultivate your realization without manufacturing any conceptual thoughts. Let your sixfold network of sensory and mental kinds of primary consciousness be carefree and loose. Cultivate practicing atop whatever appearances dawn. With your awareness softly yet vividly discharging within that state, set it in an uncontrived manner on the way things are. Moreover, concerning that meditation state, without purposely trying to achieve a blissful state of bliss, a clear state of clarity making, a stark state of starkness, or an excellent state of excellence, do not wish that something else had happened concerning what has already passed. Do not cogitate about what has not yet happened. Do not think about what is presently happening. Do not meditate by intellectualizing. Do not get involved in investigating or scrutinizing what is and is not. Rather, in a state in which your mind is dropped down to its natural state, at ease, fresh and clean, unlabored, and not anxiously caring, set it in a state of the mind's intrinsic nature. Then it will be set in a state of inseparable appearance voidness, inseparable resounding voidness, inseparable bliss voidness, inseparable knowing awareness, and inseparable clarity-making voidness. The realization of inseparable appearance voidness like that, with bare non-conceptual cognition that does not obstruct appearances, but is parted from conceptually grasping them, is the dawning of an exceptionally perceptive state of vipassana into appearances. Thus, that is a state of having met face-to-face the essential nature of the mind as being Dharmakaya, a unified pair of appearance and voidness. Continually cultivate that state itself, and you will develop stable experiences and perfect realizations. That, then, is getting to know mind's essential nature face-to-face atop appearances. In other words, since it is the third getting to know its essential nature face-to-face, and thus the third actual fundamental step for attaining a state of vipassana, cultivate practicing like that is the seventh point for vipassana meditation. Further, there is getting to know mind's essential nature face-to-face after having examined which one is it. Are the settled and stirring minds the same or different? When you scrutinize whether the settled and stirring minds were the same or different, then, from realizing that the essential nature of the two is the same, you became aware of conceptual thought as something to be included within the sphere of meditation. You realize that the manner of their dawning with which those two, the settled and stirring minds, are nothing other than the same, is that they dawn by alternating. The agent that is not stirring at the time when it is settled, and not settled at the time when it is stirring, is just the functioning mind alone. And the essential nature of those two does not go beyond their being denuded clarity-making and voidness. Concerning that, you also realize that conceptual thoughts that all of a sudden arise from the first are themselves a denuded clarity-making and voidness, without being the case that, after you draw in a thought, then you see a denuded clarity-making and voidness, or that, in the wake of a conceptual memory having disappeared, the mind went into a clarity-making and voidness. And when it came to, isn't it like that, you are now aware of the abiding nature of the mind. As it says in the expression, the mind falls into fingers of being settled or stirring, whether settled in serene clarity-making and non-conceptual state, or having been stirred with conceptual thoughts, the essential nature of the mind, or of conceptual thoughts themselves, is a denuded clarity-making and voidness, and nothing more than that. With the realization that all appearances or cognitive objects are spectacular emanations of the mind, all are like water and waves, and aside from that, none can be established in any way as an ultimate phenomenon, you will now be in a state of having met face-to-face the essential nature of appearances as mind. With the realization that the mind cannot be established as a something, through having scrutinized its essential nature in terms of the trio, a going, an abiding, and a coming about, and so, like a horse or an elephant in a dream, that it cannot be established as an ultimate phenomenon, you will be in a state of having met face-to-face mind as voidness. With the realization that, while being a voidness, yet within a state of clarity-making and lucidity, assorted appearances dawn, spontaneously accomplishing themselves with no obstruction, like the appearance of a moon in water, you will be in a state of having met face-to-face voidness as spontaneously establishing appearances, and with the certitude that without the mind wavering from still being after having merely spontaneously established appearance, a clarity-making knowing voidness that spontaneously establishes appearances, parted from mental fabrication, unchanging in nature and greatly blissful, spontaneously established appearances dawn and automatically liberate themselves simultaneously, like a snake knotting and uncoiling itself. You will be in a state of having met face to face the spontaneous establishment of appearances as automatically liberating themselves. That mind, which is something to get to know face to face, that normal awareness, stirring with all sorts of conceptual thoughts, knowing this and that, darting here and there, just that is called the unified pair of clarity-making voidness, great blissful awareness, voidness possessing the supreme of all aspects, or it is called Mahamudra, the great seal. Since when you recognize it, that is called the realization of Mahamudra, set your mind on that normal awareness as a vividly wide-awake knowing that is naturally present all along, without there being anything whatsoever to be meditated on, and without meandering for even an instant. When in a relaxed and loosened-up state, with no hopes or worries to be had, such as hoping for your meditation to be good, or worrying about it being faulty, you have cultivating seeing the natural face of normal awareness, in that moment you will be seeing Mahamudra, that unified pair of visible awareness, voidness, like the expanse of the cloudless pure sky. Now your states of stilled and settled shamatha and exceptionally perceptive vipassana will be a joined pair, and your boon experiences and stable realizations will be superior. Since you will be implanting this as a pathway mind to liberation, it will serve as one. Voidness is mind's intrinsic nature. Clarity making is mind's defining characteristic. The unity of that pair is mind's essential nature. Parted from all extremes of mental fabrication, excellent and bad, the trio, arising, ceasing, and abiding, existence and non-existence, static and non-static, and so on, beyond words and thought, and yet, though parted from being recognizable as a this, still exists as something that is experienced, this vividly wide-awake, stark clarity-making, with an intrinsic nature of bliss, clarity, and non-conceptuality, has many names. It is called the identity nature of great deep awareness, the actual nature of the great self-arising, the abiding nature that is the character of what is validly knowable, perfect awareness, the accordant nature of reality, the equal nature of samsara nirvana, great blissful awareness, Buddha nature, the womb containing a thusly gone one, prajnaparamita, far-reaching discriminating awareness, the omniscient mind, the deepest, and voidness possessing the supreme of all aspects. Because all phenomena can be realized as the mind, it is called chittamatra, mind only. Because it is parted from all extremes in the middle, it is called Mahamadhyamaka, the great middle way. Because it is difficult for everyone to realize, it is called Guhya Mantra, the secret protection for the mind. Because this smashes all deceptions, it is called Vajrayana, the diamond-hard vehicle of mind. Because it beholds the essential nature of Buddhahood, it is called Dharmakaya, a corpus encompassing everything. In short, non-dual deep awareness, parted from all mental fabrication that conceptually grasps duality, the equal nature of samsara and nirvana, great blissful awareness, parted from mental fabrication, the great seal of Mahamudra, that is what you have now met, face to face. With regard to that, in implanting as your vital point firm conviction and appreciation for your guru, you will be soaring above samsara. And never having enough of making requests to him or her to be able to meet face-to-face the essential nature of your mind, you will be circling above samsara. In his or her inspiration directly entering your mind, you will be descending onto mind's essential nature. By having now met face-to-face what is present, unhidden and obvious as an intrinsic part of yourself, unobstructed and denuded, you will be landing on top of basis Mahamudra. You will be seeing its essential nature as pathway Mahamudra. You will be ascertaining it as resultant Mahamudra. Therefore, cultivate these states like this with joy. Having now made your attainment of a precious human body meaningful, and by implanting Mahamudra as your pathway mind to liberation, having made your samsaric existence have an end, meditate well and with joy, and cultivate this for a long time. That's very important. Having examined the settled and stirring minds, what you get to know face to face is appearances as mind, mind as voidness, voidness as spontaneously establishing appearances, and the spontaneous establishment of appearances as automatically liberating themselves, in other words, Mahamudra. Having gotten to know this as pointing a finger at Dharmakaya, and having cultivated its practice continually like that, then, without the serenity of merely an intellectual understanding to reach the end point of the path, making sure to have packed it on your mental continuum is the eighth point for Vipassana meditation. As for these above 8 points, that was one way of having organized getting to know face-to-face the joint pair of shamatha and vipassana in 4 actual fundamental steps, namely in relation to the settled mind, the stirring mind, appearances, and the settled and stirring minds together. It was first to focus on examining the central natures of all 4, and then, having generated recognition of all of them in progressive order, to get to know them face-to-face in accordance with your understanding. The other way is to have organized them such that after each method for having generated recognition of the essential nature of one of the 4, you have each getting to know that essential nature face-to-face in accordance with your understanding. Although that is also all right, yet here, without relying on a mass of sentences, I have organized the methods for examining the 4 in just this one way. Having arranged one by one in progressive order, like an alphabet list of steps A, B, and C, these steps for getting to know face-to-face the essential nature of the mind in accordance with gaining decisiveness about it to your innermost core and its signs, I have written this in accordance with the methods to have generated them when the occasion has arisen that you have become actually ready to generate them properly. If, however, from the start, your guru had tried to bring you to get to know face-to-face the essential nature of your mind without leading you first through a thorough examination of its nature, that superficial getting to know it face-to-face would have made you close-minded and smug. Since there is the danger that, when people familiar with the Dharma have become close-minded and smug, they will be unable to have generated stable realizations on their mental continuums, then to eliminate that danger, I have organized like that the methods for bringing disciples to get to know face-to-face the essential natures of their minds. Those steps are the actual fundamental part of the Mahamudra practice.